It's been 83 years since Commander Robert E. Perry said he stood at the North Pole, the first explorer ever to do that. On April 6, 1909, Perry claimed the North Pole. But another man, Dr. Frederick Cook, said he got there first, and many people have said that Perry didn't get to the pole at all. On Conversations today, we might actually set the record straight. I'm Susan McInnes. With me is Douglas R. Davies. He is the president of the Navigation Foundation here in the United States, and he was on the team that was asked to prove or disprove Perry's claim. Welcome, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Doug, I don't think any of us, well, certainly not many of us, will ever get to the North Pole. And we certainly won't be able to experience it from Perry or Frederick Cook's perspective, the struggle it took them to get there. Can you give us an enhanced snapshot of the pole? I know that Greenland is the farthest north jutting area of land, and the rest is the Arctic Ocean. But tell us what it looks like. What does that mean?
Well, the North Pole is 413 nautical miles from the land in Ellesmere Island, a little closer to the northern tip of Greenland. But it's in the middle of a vast ocean that is frozen over, almost completely solid, but not quite, pretty much the year round. The water near land in the summer opens up some, and even in the winter, leads in the so-called leads in the ice splits open up as the wind drives the ice and pushes it apart and crushes it together in other places. Particularly near land, there are huge so-called pressure ridges where the plates of ice are driven into each other and against the land and push up at the intersection points of the ice. And it's, in many cases, a very rough, difficult surface. Often, even in the early spring months when people travel, open water that can't be crossed. And it's a pretty difficult environment to make any headway in.
What's the temperature range? How cold is it there?
I think Perry said that the coldest he experienced in his trip, which started in February, late February, was about minus 50. And it's probably colder in the winter.
Perry was a fellow who, among other achievements, decided that the smartest people in the Arctic were the Inuit, the Eskimos who lived there. And he took on their clothing and way of living. What adaptations did he make?
Well, that's right. He went to Greenland several times, first for a short visit in 1886, and then for 3 years in the 1890s. And at first, he didn't necessarily think they had the right way of surviving in the North. He tried, for example, importing burros to use for transportation to pull sledges, and the burros couldn't tolerate the cold and ended up simply being a source of food for the dogs. He used dog sleds for transportation exclusively. Most of the time, most of his expeditions, he was accompanied by Inuit drivers. He himself could drive a sledge, although in the later expeditions he didn't. His principal companion, Matt Henson, became a very proficient sledge driver. But most of the sledges were driven by Inuit drivers, and he used the Greenland dogs. He used the furs, the different types of furs, the seal skin and so on, and boots and so on, all the traditional garb of the Smith Sound Eskimos in Greenland.
I've seen a picture of him that's at the very front of his book. He's holding what appears to be a long harpoon, and he's on snowshoes. He's literally head to foot in fur with the fur side out. He looks like a lean, human-formed bear.
That's right. It was the traditional Eskimo garb. And many of the explorers who traveled in those times in Ellesmere Island still wore European clothing, woolens. But Perry felt that the furs were warmer and handled the moisture better and so on. And actually, he used igloos rather than tents. He didn't use sleeping bags. He just slept in those furs. So once they were on, they were
pretty much on there.
And but again, it enabled him to travel light and stay warm. He had even he, with all the adaptations he made, did have some trouble with frostbite, but by and large his parties were free from that.
Our guest today on Conversations is Doug Davies. He was a civil engineer for about 10 years and then decided for a career change and became a lawyer. He's been a lawyer for a number of years, works for the Mobil Corporation, but he has a hobby, which his father introduced him to, Rear Admiral Davies, and that is celestial navigation. And the two of them, along with other members of a team, were invited by the National Geographic Society to use their skills of navigation and mathematics, and also, I think, their skills of doggedness to either prove or disprove whether Admiral Robert E. Perry achieved the pole. Our topic today on Conversations, did Perry or did he not? When Commander Perry wrote, I think it's a letter to his wife, but I'm not sure, it is his letter that says, I have achieved the pole, he wrote about 23 years of effort.
Right.
Suffering and privation and risk-taking and excitement. He also wrote about what he called almost 400 years effort, loss of life, loss of fortune by what he called the civilized nations of the world to achieve the pole. People have been trying to reach the North Pole for nearly 400 years, at least at the time of his writing?
Well, I think people have been trying to reach the North Pole. I suppose if you go back to the pre-Christian era, you find people exploring the North, and the Pythias, the Greek, arriving at what he called the Ultima Thule, the farthest north, and where that was, I think we still don't know. After the golden era of discovery opened up with Columbus in 1500, many explorers realized that the shortest way from England to China, to the China trade, would be close to the pole, the so-called Northwest Passage. You know, now if you fly by airplane, you would come pretty much right over Alaska. If there were a Northwest Passage by sea, where it would be, the shortest route. Many of the early explorers, I think, were looking more for the Northwest Passage than for the pole per se, but part of the efforts of all those explorers was to reach the pole. And I think really in the 1800s, the early 1800s, the serious efforts to actually get to the pole, head out over the ice with the sleds pulled by men or dogs or whatever, really started in the early 1800s.
If we take a look at some of the modern explorers, Perry wanted to claim the pole for the United States of America. Cook, Frederick Cook, just wanted to get there. In fact, he talks about it as the ultimate egotism of what he calls the human unit in his book, which tells me he may have had a sense of humor about himself, which is kind of nice to know. But why do you think people have had such a personal urging to get there?
Well, I think, in a way, Cook's description of his motivation may be a little more honest, in a way. Perry, from a very early time, was intent on reaching the pole, and he viewed it as a way of not only achieving glory for the country, that was part of his motivation, but he certainly also viewed it as a way of making a name for himself and making to him, fame, immortality of his name was very important, and he saw that as a way of achieving it. And he was very determined. He set himself to that goal. He decided that was going to be the way he was going to make his mark. And as you referred to, for 23 years, he pursued that goal.
He traveled twice across Greenland, and that itself was an achievement, was it not?
Yes, it was. That was a distance of 500 miles or more, and at that time he was heading to an area that was equally unknown as the North Pole. So the distance really was pretty much the same as his polar journey. The advantage he had is that he was on land in that case, so that he didn't have to worry about open water and ice pressure ridges and so on. Mm-hmm. But it was a very long journey, very perilous. He went, pushed on beyond the limits of his supplies, hoping to find game when he got to the far side of the island of Greenland, and he did find game, but if he had not, he would have perished.
You said when I was listening to a lecture of yours that he wasn't afraid to risk his life. There are a couple of incidents that show this, one in which his leg was badly broken. How did that happen?
Oh, well, I don't think that was a life-threatening situation. He was on the ship going up to Greenland for the first expedition, and the tiller of the ship swung suddenly and hit his leg and broke his leg. And people suggested that he call off the expedition and come back the next year, but he didn't. That's an indication, I think, of his determination. Dr. Cook was on his party at that time and set his leg, and he was carried ashore and as an invalid directed the construction of his camp, which was a wooden building in near Etah, but he persisted. He wintered over and then set out for Greenland the next spring, for the northeast part of Greenland the next spring.
I want to do two things. One is to get a picture of these two men and then take a look at how they got embroiled in the question of who's actually won this achievement. Cook is described as generous, a good physician. He, I understand, saved the lives of an entire expedition in Antarctica just by keeping up their determination, which if you know about, you can tell us a little bit about. On the other hand, Perry is described as arrogant, a martinet, exploitive, self-aggrandizing, but also, not so parenthetically, courageous, generous, willing to take his people as far as they will go and bring them back all alive and safe. Where's the balance? Who are these two men?
Well, I think, as you said, Cook was a very likable person. Apparently, he got along well with everyone he met. He charmed, literally charmed the country when he came back with his claim of having reached the pole. He went on speaking tours. There are pictures that that I've seen from those tours. He's a handsome man, very well liked. He was a good member of Peary's expedition. Peary got along with him very well then. They only started to have their falling out when he started to compete with Peary rather than simply be a member of his party. Peary, I think people have described in less favorable terms, but I think it's important to, if you read the books of, for example, Captain Bob Bartlett, who was the captain of the ship that Peary went on the last two expeditions to the pole, and the books of Macmillan and Borup, members of that party, he had the respect of his men. He was not a martinet. People would follow him virtually anywhere, and he did have a very uncanny knack of bringing them back alive. On more than one occasion, he really did rescue and save the lives of people in his party.
Cook set out a year before Perry?
Right. Cook set out from New York City while Perry was busy getting his ship ready to go north. And Cook set out, I believe, sponsored by a Mr. Bradley, and said he was going polar bear hunting. He didn't say anything about the pole. But I think even from that moment, Peary was concerned that Cook was encroaching on what he viewed as his domain. Peary was very jealous of that area, the Ellesmere Island and Greenland area, as a route to the pole. He felt that other people, other explorers, didn't really have a right to come in there until he was done and had given it his best shot.
Because he'd earned it?
Well, he was there first.
Yeah.
Well, he wasn't there first. He was of the people who were still active. He was there first. There had been people before, of course. When Otto Sverdrup started exploring in 1904 in Ellesmere Island and what he named Axel Heiberg Land, Peary was quite jealous of that. I'm sorry, that wasn't in 1904. That was in 1896, 97. When Cook headed for that direction, Peary, I think, was nervous. When Peary got to Etah later, he wasn't ready to go yet. When he got to Etah, he found a man left behind with some of Cook's supplies and he got the story that Cook had gone off for the North Pole. And I don't remember the exact details of this, but basically Peary put a man ashore to guard Cook's, quote, guards Cook's supplies, and went to Cook's shed and put a note on it, "This is the property of Dr. Cook, now dead." The theory was he had headed off for the pole and he wasn't expected back. I think Peary at that time, as he was heading north, thought that Cook didn't have a realistic chance. Cook had set out with only two other men, two Eskimos, to set out across Ellesmere Island to go a much further distance west and up. It would have been a much longer route than the route Peary took.
When Peary made his trip and came back, Cook had just made his announcement after a year away that he himself had gotten to the pole. Peary's announcement seemed more definitive and started this controversy. Why was Peary doubted? What was wrong with his presentation of his achievement that made people think he hadn't gotten there after all?
Well, I think people doubted both claims. Peary, on his way back from the pole, knew before he announced his own attainment of the pole, he had found out from the Eskimos that Cook was claiming to have reached the pole. Cook took a lot longer time to get back. He went all the way down to the southern tip of Greenland and then got on a whaling ship and went to Denmark. And actually, Cook was in Denmark being entertained royally for his attainment of the pole when the announcement of Peary's attainment of the pole came over the telegraph. And there's actually a photograph of Cook at that convention hearing the news that Peary had made the pole. But since Peary knew when he got down to the telegraph station that Cook had made the claim, the second thing he did after he claimed the pole for himself was to announce that Cook was a fake and that the world had been, in his words, handed a gold brick. And I think that set off, first Peary was regarded as unsportsmanlike for having attacked Cook without seeing his proof or understanding anything about his claim. Actually, Peary had investigated it by talking to the Eskimos who went with Cook. And secondly, people became aware of the fact that these claims are inherently not provable. The North Pole is just a spot. It has mathematical meaning, but there's nothing there. There's no, there's ice, but any monument, any marker that was left there within a short time would be far away from the pole. Within a year or two would be down in the East Greenland Sea somewhere.
Once again, it's the pressure of the ice that's
right.
Moving things.
And there's a general tendency of the ice to move in that one direction because of currents under the pole.
So if you plant your flag, it's going to disappear within a matter of months.
That's right. It won't be there. And so inherently, it is a difficult thing to prove. Peary, I think, was criticized also for having, although he had Captain Bob Bartlett, a Newfoundlander, with him, and Ross Marvin, a professor of engineering from Cornell, that when he went to pick his team to go the final 135 miles to the pole, he picked him, in addition to himself, Matt Henson, who was a relatively uneducated, certainly literate in some ability in mathematics, but not the training that a sea captain or a professor would have. Matt Henson was a black man, and people thought that Peary might have picked him because he couldn't effectively contradict anything Peary said. No one would believe him, it's sad to say, in 1910. And for Eskimos, for Inuits from Greenland. I think Peary took those people for two reasons. One, I think that was the best team he could have put together for the high-speed sled driving that they needed to make it to the pole. And secondly, I think Peary really did not want to share the honor of getting to the pole with Bob Bartlett, who was who later became a significant explorer in his own right and certainly would have taken a share of the honor. So
it was both practical and egotistical.
It was. It was both. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, people were found that to be suggestive that maybe he didn't, maybe he wasn't being honest about where he went. I think the distance that he covered, which was 135 miles in five marches, people thought was, it was a lot higher speed than they had been covering up to that time. Although they had been getting progressively faster as they got further and further from the land, the ice conditions were better and better, because right at the land, the ice is being driven into the land and the pressure ridges are building up higher and so forth. But I think the choice of people that went along and the fact that the expedition seemed to get a little too easy towards the end, I think, were the main things that got people suspicious. And of course the fact that you just can't really prove that you've been there.
Two of his chief critics in this day and age have said that it's not possible, as you've said, to go as fast as he went, in part because he would keep getting shoved off course by the ice, the movement of the ice, and he'd have to keep zigzagging. So if he claimed 30 miles a day, he would actually have had a forward movement. He would mm-hmm. actually have had to go 60 miles a day of zigzag movement to make that.
Well, the zigzag, the theory of the zigzag, and this is principally advocated, I guess, by Wally Herbert, mm-hmm. who is a sled driver himself and who went to the pole himself. But the theory of the zigzag is not so much that the ice has moved, although that would be part of it, but that you would come to open water and have to detour to find a place where you could get across it. Or more likely, that far north, you would come to pressure ridges that were too big to get over. The evidence that Wally Herbert, or the estimate of how much you would add to your course by zigzagging that Wally Herbert espouses is really, in my view, not representative of what Peary would encounter. And the reason is this. Wally Herbert had a party of four people. Four sleds, four people. The sled loads, fully loaded, his sleds were 1,300 pounds. So when they came to an obstacle where the choice was to go around it or go over it, they had one set of equations to look at. Peary had six people, and the sleds fully loaded were 540 pounds.
Lighter, faster.
Much lighter sleds. And so when you come to an obstacle with a sled that's only 540 pounds, and you have six sleds, but you can all sort of take them over one at a time over the obstacle with the dogs still pulling and six people to help, I think the notion that you would have to go through as many detours in that situation is just, I just think it's a different condition. And of course it depends, the amount of detouring you do depends on how rough the ice is. Peary's own diary talks about how good the ice was, how smooth it was in the last 5 days. The Eskimos who went with Peary were interviewed by later explorers who went to the Greenland area, and they agreed that the going was easy and that they could have easily gone further and so on. And importantly, the photographs that we've looked at that show the progress of the expedition in the later phases appear to have very smooth ice.
Three photographs helped you decide that Peary actually had stood at the top of the world. I'll ask you to do it briefly. Can you tell us how those three photographs convinced you that Peary got there?
Yes, there are quite actually a number of photographs. Any photograph can be, if you know the features of the camera and principally the focal length, that is how far the lens of the camera is from the photographic plate, you can relate the position of objects on the photographic plate or on the negative to the angle away from the camera that those objects would be in the real world. Mm-hmm. If the sun is in a picture, you can measure the angle of the sun from the center line of the camera by that method. And if the horizon is in the picture, you can tell what the angle of the horizon is relative to the camera. And by putting that information together where you have the sun and the horizon, you can measure mathematically with trigonometry how far above the horizon the sun is. Now, astronomers and navigators have always had available, since about 1767, they've had something called the Nautical Almanac. And that tells you on any day of the year how high the sun is above the equator. And by knowing that, if you're at the North Pole, you know how high the sun should be above the horizon. It's the same number. So knowing the date that Peary said he was at the North Pole, we were able to calculate that the sun should have been it ranged for over the hours that he was there from about 6 degrees and 40 minutes, that is 6 and 2/3 degrees above the horizon, to just slightly over 7 degrees. One picture that we had, the sun itself was clearly visible, and it came out exactly right in that range. Quite a number of other pictures, the sun is not shown in the picture. However, you can use the fact that lines, for example, if you have a large picture with the sun in it, and you might find some of these around somewhere and just look, you will see that objects and their shadows, the line through them always goes back to the sun. And even if you take a smaller picture and the sun isn't in it, you can still draw those lines and project out to where the sun would be.
See where the angles are.
And then tell by that position of where the sun would be, you can measure how high it is above the horizon. And we did that to really, I suppose 15 pictures. I don't know exactly, maybe 12 to 15 pictures, and they all came out right.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. We're talking with Doug Davies, who, as he's been saying, is on the team that said, did Peary make it or not? With these photographs, along with the other evidence, do they tell you that Admiral Robert E. Peary did what he said he did?
They tell me that he made it to the pole. Yeah. And I think to say that anyone can analyze a photograph with such precision that you could say to the mile where he is, I wouldn't claim that. You can tell to, let's say, within 15 miles where he is. And the photographs, if you looked at nothing else, the photographs tell you that he had to be within that kind of range, 15, maybe 20 miles of the pole. He had to be within that range. Now, when you add in his own sextant observations that he took, that people claim could have been faked, but his own sextant observations show that he was there. And when you look at the history he had of determination and of not turning back and of courage and so on, it's just inconceivable to me that he would have been close to the pole, and meaning 20 miles or so, and faked it. So I think when you put it all together, the impression you get of the person, the fact that all the evidence fits, the fact that he did take these sites, and sometimes when sites can be faked, but for example, Dr. Cook faked some sites and he made mistakes and you could catch it. Mm. Peary's sites look fine. There's nothing wrong with them. And when you put it all together, my conclusion is yes, he was right where he said he was. His camp was about 4 miles from the pole.
What's the greatest thing about that achievement to you?
I think the greatest thing about it is simply the perseverance, the fact that whether or not it's a particularly worthy goal, that a man can set his sights on something is a very, very difficult and very dangerous accomplishment. I don't think people typically today understand how dangerous and difficult it was. Peary was 413 miles out on the ice if he was at the pole. And even if he was where critics say he might have been, 350. It was far, far out on moving ice, danger of open water, no such thing as radio. Nobody had any way of possibly coming to his assistance. He might as well have been on the moon for as much as he was relying completely on his own ability and skill to get himself back. So there were great dangers. It was a goal that Peary felt was worth achieving. I think it had some scientific value because it was then unknown what was at the pole. But I think the main thing is just the determination, the ability to pick a task, dedicate himself to it, and get it done.
Now, what about Frederick Cook? This is a man who, you said, well-liked by people. I've read, extremely courageous, willing to fight a whole crew's desperation to keep people alive in Antarctica. Had certain achievements in his own life, and yet he said he reached the top of Mount McKinley and evidently didn't. And he said he reached the pole and evidently didn't. I suppose I'm asking you now to be the psychiatrist, mathematician. Why do you think, having looked somewhat at this second claim and certainly very closely at Perry's claim, why would someone claim to have gotten there when he didn't?
Well, I suppose he wanted fame and recognition as well. He certainly, as a result of those claims, was he had a fairly brief lecture career while his claims were still holding up. He was president of the Explorers Club. I suppose, in a way, Cook was trying to get what Peary did achieve, which Peary had even before going to the pole, which was the recognition of prominent businessmen. Peary had many prominent businessmen among his supporters. There was a spin-off of the Explorers Club called the Peary Arctic Club, which was a bunch of rich old railroad people who contributed money to finance Peary's claim.
Fans on a high scale?
Fans on a high scale, groupies. Huh. And they, and Cook never had that. Cook did have the backing of a Dr. Bradley for his expedition, but it was a pretty modest thing by comparison. And I think Cook probably realized that people like success. You know, success has lots of friends, and maybe that's why he decided to try to claim that he had been to the pole. What he apparently did instead of going to the pole, if you believe the story of the Eskimos, was a very, very dangerous and difficult year-long circumnavigation of Ellesmere Island under harrowing conditions. He obviously was a great person at surviving in those conditions, great hunter, a great traveler in Arctic regions, and very courageous, but I don't think he went to the pole.
You know, it's interesting, as you're describing these people, both Peary and Cook, I'm thinking about the qualities of heroes and wondering about both Cook and Peary if heroes aren't kind of larger-than-life personalities with larger-than-life desires and needs and ambitions, but also larger-than-life foibles. Does that fit into any picture you would have?
Well, certainly heroes, I think, are not what they used to be. I think we see heroes largely because of the communications and the press and so on. We don't see only one side of heroes anymore. We see all sides of them. And they all have their foibles, no question about it. Peary had ambition that would allow him to do sometimes foolhardy things. When he found Otto Sverdrup searching camped out in Ellesmere Island, he immediately decided to head north even though it was winter, and as a result he lost 8 of his toes to frostbite. He wouldn't stop and have coffee with the man. You would think that in the middle of this wilderness you would be some kinship between Western men, but he would have falling outs with people. He had a falling out with his doctor at one point and sent the doctor away, and then the fever struck his encampment and a number of people died, and whether the doctor could have helped that or not, I don't know, but the point is the man was not perfect. I think today these things would have been and today they are now being brought out by the critics. But in 1910, nobody made much of an issue of these things. Well, Peary had children from among the Eskimos. These things were, to the extent they were known, they were kept very quiet and suppressed. The idea, I think, in those days was you focus on the good of the hero and you turn him into something that he really wasn't. But I think in a way we've gone too far the other way. We look at the bad. We say, sure, these guys, everybody thinks they're heroes, but they have feet of clay. Well, of course they do, but they also accomplish great things. They were courageous. And I think we've gone a little bit too far back the other way.
Does that say something about our sophistication or lack thereof, that we either have to have a perfect hero or he or she can't be a hero at all?
Well, I think it's sophistication in a way. I think maybe what we need is the sort of the willing suspension of disbelief. We should be able to say there is something in heroes, something in some people that is good enough, that even though we, unlike in the past where we just didn't know the bad, we know and recognize the bad, but nevertheless reward the good.
Mm-hmm. Let me reintroduce our listeners to our guest. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations on KUAC-FM. Doug Davies is the president of the Navigation Foundation. He succeeded his father as the president of the Navigation Foundation. His father is the late Rear Admiral Thomas D. Davies, a lifelong Navy man who served under several presidents. Prior to that, served in World War II. Doug Davies, the president of the foundation, its full name, the Foundation for the Promotion of the Art of Navigation. Among other things that it does, the Navigation Foundation believes that celestial navigation, one of the original navigation forms, should still be promoted, even though this is a day of electronics. This is Conversations on KUAC. I want to ask another question about heroes, and that is whether they're out of fashion in this day and age. And if you think they are, what does that say about us, the folks who put them out of fashion? A preface to that, I listened to a professor telling me recently that she asked one of her classes if they had heroes, and these university students of all ages said no. I was quite surprised about that, and it made me wonder about whether we've kind of put ourselves out of the business of acknowledging heroes in our lives.
Well, I think that may be right. I think heroes are, I think today there's so much emphasis on equality, egalitarianism, democracy, and so on, that it's difficult to recognize individual achievement. And it's difficult to say that a certain person, not that they're a better person, surely, but that for one aspect of their life possess a quality that the rest of us don't have and that we should take some inspiration from, or maybe not that we don't have it, that we haven't developed it. I think heroes are hard to come by these days. Every presidential election seems to fail to turn any up.
This is true. Is that a loss, cultural loss, from your perspective?
Well, I think it probably is. I think it's for people to have someone to aspire to, someone just reading about them gives you a sense of amazement, wonder, pride, something to strive for. I think that's good, and I think we are losing that.
Do you have heroes?
Do I have heroes? I really am not sure I do have heroes. I'm probably equally a victim of the sort of egalitarian approach. I think the last hero I probably had was John Kennedy, and I'm not sure I would have that hero today. I don't think any of us would have that hero today, because he certainly had his foibles. And on the other hand, he was a hero because he had a vision of what the country ought to be, and whether he was completely selfless and so on, he was able to turn that vision into accomplishments, into action. And a lot of course, what he wanted to get done never happened all the way, but he certainly got a lot of people started in a certain ideological direction, which I think was good.
I want to switch subjects for a moment, although it certainly is related in a way. William Hunt, who wrote To Stand at the Pole, it's a Stein and Day publication brought out in 1981, said that he wrote about the Cook-Perry controversy because it's a whale of a good story. But also, he made this observation, and I'll quote from his foreword here, the mystery is not simply whether or not Cook accomplished what he claimed, but it is the receptivity of people to arguments they wish to believe. That is to say, people have stayed with Cook's claim kind of no matter what, and that people have stayed stuck in the controversy because it's a controversy. Do you think it's just human nature that we say, nah, he didn't do it, yeah, he did?
Well, I think there are a couple things. First of all, I mean, the continued adherence to Cook is surprising. It's hard to understand, but there is a society today still that espouses a belief that Cook made it to the pole. And they're really going against all the evidence. But I think people like to get involved in a controversy like this. They like to find out something, know something that everybody else missed. There are lots of people out there who collect every scrap of information about this Peary controversy. And I think people, certainly when I was going to elementary school, 25, 30 years ago, the teaching was that Admiral Peary was the first person to the North Pole in 1909. End of subject, no question, that was it. And I think a lot of people, some of the writers, Dennis Rollins, who has written extensively on this subject, I think get a charge out of taking a concept, a popularly held belief, and proving that it's wrong, that they sort of outsmart the world by doing that, that you guys all thought this, but look what I found out. And I think that's really what motivates people to look into these kinds of things. And it may be part of what motivates me to look into them, too, to say, he thought that you were all wrong, but no, you're not, and look what I found out, how smart I am. So I think it is an achievement. It's a task, a challenge to go back and try to figure out what really did happen. The historical truth is hard to find. It's a challenge to go after it, and there's a sense of satisfaction of being the one who was able to find it.
Mm-hmm. How did you get involved? The National Geographic came to the foundation, but why?
Well, the National Geographic has been involved more or less with Peary and the Peary controversy since the very beginning. They were a small contributor to Peary before he left for his trip, and when Peary returned, the National Geographic appointed a commission of experts to talk to Peary, analyze his claim, and decide whether he did or did not get to the pole. And that group, after actually a fairly shallow investigation, really a fairly short investigation, mostly, I think, they felt they wanted to talk to Peary and get a sense of his credibility and so on, and I think they were satisfied and said, okay, he made it. So the National Geographic, in a way, had its prestige on the line behind Peary. Thereafter, the Peary controversy sort of percolated along for many, many years, but only became really active quite recently. In the 80s, early 80s, some of the Peary archives were made available for the first time. And the Geographic hired Wally Herbert to go back, since he had been to the pole himself, to go back through the archive. And Herbert wrote an article in the Geographic, which was actually fairly negative on Peary. I think if you read the actual words, it was a sort of casting doubt. But if you read between the lines, it was saying he really didn't make it. And Herbert's later book certainly took that position, that Peary didn't make it. about the time that Herbert was looking at these newly available archive materials, or after that, or just after his article came out, this fellow I mentioned before, Dennis Rawlins, went through the same archives and found a slip of paper, and it was in an envelope that said, I don't remember exactly, but original observations 1909 or something like that. And there was a certain amount of documents and discussion of what that was that led Rawlins to believe that it was a record of his solar observations taken at the North Pole. And assuming that that's what they were, he went on to analyze these very ambiguous and very cryptic notes and come up with a theory that Peary was 132 miles away. That made sort of first page news, front page news. It was on all the major papers and the major networks in 1988.
Peary a fraud.
Peary proven to be a fraud.
Yeah.
The Geographic, I think this was a little more than they were ready for. They wanted to look at that piece of paper themselves, but they really didn't feel that they had in-house the expertise. This is a very cryptic, incomplete document, and they had people, they didn't feel that in-house people could really get to the bottom of it. So they went to the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C. And the Naval Observatory really didn't have the manpower, and it wasn't, I think, a sort of, in their view, a proper way for them to use the manpower they did have. But at that time, my father was working with the Naval Observatory on the publication of the Nautical Almanac, and so they suggested him. And the Geographic went to him, and that's how we got started.
The rest is history, as they say.
The rest is history.
Yeah. Why were you interested? I mean, your father was the point man on this. You're a civil engineer and an attorney, happily employed with a life of your own.
Well, I have to say, the minute that paper came out with the headline, Peary proved a fake, I remember reading that edition of the Post and saying, boy, I'd like to get my hands on that piece of paper, because this just sounds fishy. There were things about it that just didn't sound right. One of the things was that the piece of paper had, the report in the Post didn't show the piece of paper in enough detail to read it, but they did say that it had the word Betelgeuse on it, which is the name of a star. And the description of why a piece of paper would have the name of a star on it when it was in fact an observation of the sun just sounded kind of hokey. And it struck me that here was a guy trying to, get some good ink for himself by coming up with a theory to debunk Peary, and it just sounded fishy. And I really wanted to get my hands on it, and when that chance came along, I was delighted.
You will have whetted appetites by talking about this piece of paper. Tell us briefly what was on it. This was a chronometer.
Well, it turns out exactly what was on it, I'm not sure is even to this day known. There have been three theories of what was on it. The first theory was the one reported in the Post, that it showed the altitude of the sun taken by Peary at 1 p.m. On one of the days when he was at his final North Pole camp.
Proving he was 137 miles away.
Right, proving that he was 131 or something miles away. The what in fact was on it, and I think one of the real tip-offs was that there were some numbers down in the lower right-hand corner of the piece of paper, 306.309 and so on. These numbers looked like and were explained by Dennis Rawlins as compass headings. But in going through the archives, the National Archives, we discovered that those were in fact the serial numbers of Peary's chronometers. And then it began to fit into place that what he was doing with this calculation recorded on this slip of paper was not determining his position, but rather checking his chronometers to see how accurate they were. We came up with a theory based on observations of two different observations of the star Betelgeuse, which was the star named. I'm sorry, two observations of the star Betelgeuse and Ras el Hagg as the other star. And we thought that it might have been from 1906. But in any event, it was clear it was not from 1909, and therefore we sort of lost interest in it. Now, Dennis Rawlins, and incidentally, he now admits that it had nothing to do with 1909 also. Having admitted that, he went back and did some further research and has published a paper in which he says, no, it is Betelgeuse and Vega are the two stars, and they were sights taken with a theodolite rather than a sextant, and that it was in 1895. And that may be correct. Oh. I don't know. But in any event, it has nothing to do with the North Pole.
Dennis Rawlins, we should say, is an astronomer, which is why he...
He's a professor of astronomy at, I believe, at Loyola College in Baltimore.
Once again, this is Conversations. My guest, Doug Davies. Doug, it feels like you have found the truth out about Perry's expedition. Is this the end of it for you? The report is prepared and provided 2 years ago to the National Geographic. Is it done?
Well, the report that was provided 2 years ago, if you had asked me that question 2 years ago, I would have said probably so. And in fact, there's a lot better information that we've gotten in the last 2 years. And we had one supplement to the report published already. And now I'm in the midst of working on, I've got some additional photographs that are, I think, even more clear evidence that Peary was at least in the very, very near vicinity of the pole, if not right there. And I think right there is really the answer. And I hesitate to say that there won't be more that turns up. And, you know, there are quite a number of photographs. The more you learn from each one, the more you can start to piece them all together. There were a number of details of Perry's movements in and around his camp in the 30 hours that he was at the pole that I think can probably have a benefit of further analysis of photographs, maybe find out a little bit more about exactly where he went and so on. So I think while I'm confident that the answer is there with the information we have now, I wouldn't be at all surprised to find more information, and I don't intend to stop looking.
Is it important to prove what happened 83 years ago to establish exactly what was there?
Well, I think you know, it's not important in the sense that the people involved are all dead, and the pole itself, we now know what's there, and anybody who wants to go and see can just take an airplane up and look. I don't think there's any scientific need to answer this question. I think two things. One is that I just find it to be a fascinating prospect to look for and seek the truth. There is a truth there. Something really did happen in 1909 out on the ice. And it's a challenge to try to find out what it was. And that's really my principal motivation. I think also there is a value, whether you believe, whether you're on my side of the controversy or whether you believe that Perry didn't make it, I think there's some value in to people in conveying the message to people who are attempting and doing similar things now, that if you fake a claim, people are going to scrutinize it later and you won't necessarily get away with it. And on the other hand, if you really did do what you said you did, people aren't going to take that away from you without having some real substantial evidence. I think it's just sort of a better world where the truth comes out in the end. And the other thing I think is that there's a message in all this about how public opinion and how the truth is brought out. As I said, we had front page headlines, Perry claim of reaching the pole is a fraud. When all that turned out to be wrong, page A21, well, we're still not sure. I think people who publish their version of the truth need to know that there are other people out there who are going to be looking at that and keeping them honest.
You said when the Rawlings, not retraction, I suppose, but his reconsideration came out, it was on what page of the Washington Post?
On the Post, it was page 821, and I'm not sure where. I know a lot of other papers did run it. It wasn't on television at all, I don't believe. And it was a retraction in the sense that he admitted that the piece of paper had nothing to do with the Polar claim. Of course, he still said the Polar claim was a fake.
Doug Davies' visit to Fairbanks has been sponsored by the Northern Studies Program at the University of Alaska Fairbanks, with additional assistance by the Arctic Institute of North America, the Friends of the University of Alaska Museum, and the Tanana Yukon Historical Society, and on your end, the Mapping Society?
The Alaska Surveying and Mapping Conference in Anchorage.
Took you to Anchorage.
Yes.
I have one last question for you, and is it just fascinating to sort through all the different versions of the truth? Each person is standing there and saying, no, my truth is true. Is it interesting to stand in front of all these people and try and figure out where it lies?
Absolutely. It's interesting to see what evidence people have, why they think it is convincing, and I think having a legal background, questions of evidence, what really should be considered relevant, what is it that persuades people? These are very interesting questions, and you find some of the strangest things that people quite honestly find to be suspicious, and I don't. But it does give you an insight into the way people think about problems.
Doug Davies, I want to thank you for spending an hour with us on Conversations. This hour devoted to the Cook-Perry controversy. Did Perry make it? The answer seems to be yes. And it sounds like we'll hear more from Doug Davies in the future on this subject. I'm Susan McInnes. This has been Conversations. I hope you'll join us again next week. Thank you, Doug.
Thank you.